Well, if we turn together to the chapter which we read in the Old Testament prophet Micah, not always the easiest books to read. These minor prophets, there's a cluster of them coming to the end of the Old Testament book. But the prophet Micah has much to say to us, which can be of great encouragement to us in this day in which we live. In verse 10, there is the challenge, or the question is asked, where is the Lord your God? And there is the mockery, very similar to the day in which we live. And that is why it's good for us to visit these minor prophets, because there is similarities in this day and age in which we live, which confronted the prophet. And it'll be a great help to us to see how the prophet dealt with his problem in his day. Because, you see, man hasn't changed. No more can you change the spots on a leopard than you can change the heart of man. Man remains the same. What the prophet here is in chapter 7, he laments. He laments and he begins with the word, woe, he says. Woe is me. The word woe directs the attention to himself. He speaks of a state of mind he is at this particular time. And I'm sure that from time to time we also can say, woe is me, as you direct your thoughts to yourself. And he is looking to the degeneration of the nation and the spiritual state of the people at this particular time. We might use this as a prophet in the singular, or you might look at it as the church in the plural, the church collectively. As individuals or as a body of God's people. And what it comes across here is that he's aware of the scarcity of God-fearers. And I'm sure this is a cause for lamenting for many of God's people as they consider the fewness of the number which are following the Lord. And that in itself brings a sense of lamenting on our part, because nothing would please us more than to see great numbers following the Lord. But if the words of Christ be of any comfort to us this morning, is that he said to us, fear not, he says, little flock, little flock. He didn't speak about multitudes following him. He was prophetic when he spoke these words. And it begins here with a lament. Woe is, says, is me. Because he speaks of the good man, he says, being perished out of the way. There were very few good men or women with which he could converse with. And he begins by using an illustration of the vintage. It was common for them when they harvested the harvest of the grapes from the vintage, that they would leave so many grapes on the branches for weary travelers passing through because of the heat and the thirst. And it was common practice to leave so much grapes on the vine tree and for travelers to pass by, and they would pluck just enough to quench their thirst and to see them through. And he likens this cluster of grapes as my soul, he says, desires the first fruit. Oh, how I would love to have the refreshing fruit of good men to share with me on the way. That's how he begins. And in verse 2, he speaks of much enmity. where there should be love and unity, there was so much enmity. He was aware of all that. And there was brother against brother, as if they had cast a net, that no one would escape. You know, it's always good to catch everything in a net, rather than with a hook, if you want to catch as much as possible. And he was also lamenting the corruption in verse 3, in high places amongst the judges and the rulers. There was so much corruption. Yeah, that's, you can see now the similarities in our own day and age. There were laws passed which were detrimental to God's laws, where evil was called good and good was called evil. And he likes it in verse 4 to briars and thorns. These things were cutting through to him and piercing him and hurting him. The Lord's people, they are hurt often when they see these things that are being passed, laws which are so detrimental to God's laws. And again in verse 5 he speaks about you couldn't trust anyone. You couldn't even trust your friends. And in verse 6 he goes as far as you couldn't even trust your very nearest and dearest, that is your own wife or husband or family. You say, well, we really have never experienced such a time as this. Well, let me remind you, dear friends, I wanted to do a study of communism some years ago. I wanted to see how the church managed to survive in the dark days of Stalin. And the first book I read was a book called The Whisperers. And I'm a reader, I read a lot of books. I don't think I've ever read a book that saddened my heart so much as this book called The Whisperers. And it's so similar to the first 6 verses of Micah chapter 7. And during Stalin's era, people were disappearing in their tens of thousands and in their millions. They reckon that over 20 million people disappeared. A knock on the door at midnight, and the man of the house would be taken away and never been seen again. So people began to whisper. They were afraid to speak aloud in case they were heard. Even the walls, they said, had ears. And no one would trust anyone. I'll give you one incident in the book. There was this woman, she was married to her husband for 40 years. Before we go any further, the idea of communism is that it owns your soul. That your soul becomes the property of the state. And people's minds were channeled that their souls were actually state-owned. This woman was married for 40 years to this man, a good man. And when they came to fetch him at midnight and disappeared, you know what she said? I never knew that he was a traitor. These are the sad things that come out when nations degenerate to such a state that one is afraid even to speak, but always to whisper. We have in our workplaces in Britain today where you can only whisper. We have people losing their jobs because they speak of the Lord. So there was the history of the Iron Curtain. So what we have here is religion at a low ebb. As low as it could go. But in verse 7, here is the prophet. As he speaks, directs attention to himself. He says, but as for me, he says, regardless of the state of the nation, we see the confidence and the trust and the faith of this man of God. We think that the only hope for the church is in seasons of brightness and seasons of joy and seasons which he can actually express herself. But you see, the school of learning is often in seasons of darkness. And that's where many, many people learn lessons that we've never learned before. And we learn from the prophet here how the church, or how you and I can, how can we react in times of woe as we direct the woe to ourselves. And three things in particular characterize this person. And that is, first of all, we find the resolution of faith. And then again, we have the resolution of patience. And we have the resolution of hope. All these things, three things which characterize this man of God. And that is the looking and the waiting and the hearing. He says, first of all, I will trust in the Lord. And then he considers the mocking of the enemy. And then we have the confession and his confidence. In verse 7, his trust in the Lord. In spite of all the darkness surrounding me, and in spite of the leanness of my own soul, I, he says, will look to the Lord. Where else could he look to but to the Lord? Now faith's eyes, the eye of faith can be dim at times, trying to focus to see bright, see things more brighter and more persuasive to one's soul. But there's one thing that faith never ceases to do. It never ceases to look. Never. I will, he says, look to the Lord. And here we have the resolution of faith. And when God implants the seed of faith in the soul, that is the beginning of the saint's perseverance. And he never ceases to look, regardless of how dim and how clustered everything seems to be. He's always looking, always. I will look, he says. And you see, this man's faith and all our faith, it is firmly established in God's mercy. That's where it has a firm hold. That's how the faith cannot slip out of the hold in which God has planted him, on his own mercy. And that is how faith never ceases to look, regardless of how awful the times are or how dark it is. You see, this man here, he is speaking of how few believers there are. He is considering the joy of fellowship. Oh, for having good men to speak to. It's like the cluster of fruit, he says, that I would pluck from the branch to quench my thirst. You can see the thirsty soul longing for companionship. And there is none. There is none. So what does he do? Well, it reminds us how much we can encourage one another. But when there is no one to help us and to encourage us, I, he says, will look to the Lord. For faith, you see, looks where nothing changes, to the unchangeable God in a changing world. Faith looks and pierces through the clouds to where he is. where nothing changes. And then he reminds us of the resolution of patience. I will wait, he says, for the God of my salvation. Now look at the assurance that comes across here. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My salvation is not something that started temporarily. It wasn't something that began in my life like a passing light, like a shooting star. No, no, no. My salvation is something permanent. My salvation is secure. My salvation is secure. And if you ask him, in whom? In my God. In my God. Because you see, faith and the confidence of this man comes across as he sees God as his deliverer. And though despondency, you could say, should be the mark of this man, yet faith refuses. If I, says the woman, can only hold on to the hem of his garment, I shall be made whole. And that's what faith is. Faith is the hand that grasps. But better still, friends, faith is not something that we generate ourselves. Faith is gifted to us, that he who loved us, he has his hold on us. He will not let us go. And that is why faith can direct its soul's confidence in my God. My God. You see, salvation is the theme of both the books of the Old and New Testament. That's the theme. If you're someone to say, what is the actual theme of the Old and the New Testament, which you Christians hold so dear? Salvation, salvation, salvation. That is the theme of the book. And in calamitous times, and surrounded by enemies, no one to converse with, no fruit to grasp from the tree, I will wait, he says, for the God of my salvation. There would have been lean times in the soul of this man. You see, to the prophet, salvation was eschatological. It was what we call the doctrine of future things. Soteriology, the doctrine of salvation. All in the hands of the omnipotent God. And it's a constant reminder to us of God's ability to save to the uttermost. That's what faith believes in. Though sometimes when we're looking for the evidence of faith, we degenerate when we look into ourselves and we take our eyes of him who loved us and gave himself for us. We can look too much into self for feelings and words we can put together so nicely like a neat package to God. Friends, we have no words. We have a person. We have a person. So here we have a man that is looking to the deliverance because, you see, their faith was so rooted in God's bringing them out of Egypt, the exodus, the deliverer, and then the resolution of hope. My God, he says, will hear me. My God. He will hear me. Now, friends, it's a wonderful thing, hope. Without hope, the people perish. And you see, hope is not based on my knowledge, but on the faithfulness of God. My God will hear my cry. Oh, from the depths to thee I cried. My God will hear my cry, because it's to him I cry. And you see, hope is based on the faithfulness of God, not on us being so successful in our Christian walk. Every one of us in here, friends, are reeling and staggering like one drunk. You see, it's the faithfulness of God that keeps the church on an even keel. And that's what we have in this chapter here. This was a man of prayer. And you see, to the church, what can we look to? But what is ultimate as regards to our vision, and that is a resurrection. The resurrection of who? Well, the prophet's vision was dim in comparison with ours. The resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. That is what we base our faith and hope and confidence on this morning. And yet, with the prophet's limited knowledge, it's wonderful to see how his faith is unwavering. Isn't that encouraging to us this morning, friends? Because when we consider the mocking of the enemy, he's aware of that, and so are you and I, aware of these things. And he says, as he turns to the enemy, "Rejoice not against me, O mine enemy." Because the enemy has been mocking in verse 10, "Where is now your God?" When he sees perhaps the church in her weakened state, isn't that the best place for the church to be? Weak. "For when I am weak," says the apostle, "then am I strong." The enemy noticed the sad state of the church, because the enemy, you see, was getting stronger and he could really mock. And the prophet directs his thoughts to him more or less in the silence of his own heart. Perhaps he might have confronted one. He says, "Rejoice not against me, O mine enemy." And then he says something which is, which we can consider as being helpful to us, because we can all fall into the same state. "When I fall," he says, "when I fall." It is possible for all of us, friends, to fall. And that is why we should always consider each other's weakness. "Fall, when I fall, in my low condition, in my deepest distress," he is saying, "I shall not always lie in the fall, because faith says, I will arise. I will not lie as a man trodden down, like salt that lost its savour, and to be cast out and to be trodden underfoot of men. In my fall, which can be probably sore and painful, I will arise. I will arise." And you see, faith is speaking in all situations. Faith is that grace that is given to the church, that regardless of how low the person can be, he never loses sight of his God. And the brightest and the most diligent and the most knowledgeable man can fall. Because you and I, friend, all of us, we carry in our bodies sin. And we carry in our bodies death. And there's not a soul on this earth that is not liable to fall. And if we were to measure ourselves on the plumb bob of God's law, we could say, oh my God, I've fallen. If we are to measure ourselves on the straightness of his measuring rod. And you see, God allows it for our good. You see, he's a wise God. And we can sometimes be foolish. The medievals, they call them. The medievals were, when we refer to the medievals, we refer to that time in the church's history, in these centuries which seem to be sort of, more or less, we don't know much about the history of the church in the 5th, 6th, 7th, although yes, we do in the historians. But they used to call the dark night of the soul. There's a wee booklet written called The Dark Night of the Soul. Because, you see, there are times when the Lord's people experience spiritual darkness. When I sit, he says, in darkness, then shall the Lord be a light unto me. When I sit in darkness, the Lord shall be a light unto me. There are times when there is spiritual darkness that comes upon the soul like a cloud and blots out the light. Blots out the light. And all believers experience it. I was reading once of Dr. Lloyd-Jones when he was plunged into terrible, terrible darkness. And as I called to say the medievals, the experience, he says, and all the saints, they will experience deep darkness. And that's to remind us that when we come to the darkness, that we may say it is common to God's church to be in the darkness. I was down in England a couple of years ago when my wife comes from and we visit at the graveyard where the parents are buried. And there was a gravestone just along from the gravestones. And there was a text on it. And there was only one person on the gravestone. The other part was blank. And the widow was still alive. But what caught my attention, the man was only 50. I'll never forget it. Born in 1944, died in 1994. My eyes just was fastened on the gravestone. Because the text came from 2 Samuel 22, 29. And it's very unusual to see a text, friends, in modern graveyards today. But one coming from the Old Testament was more unusual still. For thou art my lamp, O Lord, and you shall lighten my darkness. That was the text that was on the gravestone. Do you know something? It was like a light shining amongst the dead. For thou art my lamp, O Lord, and the Lord will lighten my darkness. That was the text, in the darkness amongst the dead. For thou art my lamp, O Lord. You see, darkness, friends, is not deadness. This man is aware of his condition. And there wasn't abandonment either. For thou art my Lord, O God. And it's not the darkness of unbelief either. And it was not the darkness of a man, will ye also go away, when the Lord saw them leaving him. You see, there is what you might call God working in the darkness, sharpening the graces of the Spirit. Like we would take the tools to the stone, and we sharpen them. And God uses means to sharpen the graces of the Spirit in the darkness, in the loneliness, in the fear, in the trembling. And then he turns to the cause of his lament. And he speaks of divine indignation. He says, I will bear, he says, the indignation of the Lord, because I have sinned against him. He directs the problem not to the surrounding enemies and the darkness around him, not to the corruption of the judge, not to the lack of the vintage and the grapes, but to his own sin, his fall, or his lapse, his fall. You see, it doesn't matter how bright we are in the faith, there can always be error. We're not free from error. And error, as John Calvin says, can also mingle with faith. I have sinned. I have sinned, and you say, what sin did you sin? Well, in chapter 6 and verse 8, he has shown thee, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of thee? But to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly before thy God. Well, I'm sure when we consider and measure ourselves against that demand, we could say, Lord, I come short. To love mercy is my faith, which is rooted in the mercy of God. Do I show mercy in my judgment of others? Am I considerate as to other people's weakness? Have I sinned against the royal law of love? When the Lord speaks of love, it's not just love, but fervent love among yourselves. When he speaks of making your calling sure, he says, give all diligence. You see, in all these areas, we could say, I have fallen. Do I delight in showing mercy? And do I walk humbly before my God? And then, faith, you see, looks to his God all the time. You see, when God permits a fall, when we consider Peter's fall, now that was sore. But God permits a fall in order to cure us. He allows sin to cure sin. And when Peter fell, when thou art, he says, strengthened, you'll be able to strengthen your brethren. When you're converted, Peter. The Peter that went into the fall was an entirely different Peter which came out of the fall. It was a Peter who was able to minister to the church and still ministers. So here we have the apostle looking to God until he pleads my cause. The Lord will bring me out of my situation. His timing, however long, until he pleads my cause and executes judgment for me. We must never forget that we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. And he is the one who will plead our cause. Because you and I, friends, regardless of how much we are in obedience to his revealed will, our shortcomings are so obvious if we measure ourselves before his holy law. He will not plead my cause if I continue in disobedience, because it's required of us a much as slithiness to be obedient to his revealed will. And he will execute judgment for me. The enemy, you can mock enemy. You've got no advocate, nor anyone to stand for you. You can mock me, you can ridicule me, and you can laugh at me. But I have won. I have won. He will plead my cause and execute judgment for me. And do you know something else? In the darkness, he will bring me forth unto the light. I shall emerge. Faith is speaking in confidence. I will emerge out of the darkness into the light of the glorious knowledge of Christ himself. He is my guide. He led me into the darkness, and he will lead me out of the darkness. For when I was in the darkness, I was never out of the light. Never. I was never out of his presence. I shall behold his righteousness, in the authorized version, or in this new version, his vindication, his righteous judgment. I shall then behold the Lord in a different way. I shall see him as a just God and Savior. I shall see and admire him for his persevering love and his long suffering. I shall admire his holiness, and I shall treasure him more and more. And these are thoughts we can glean from the prophet as in his day, and so also in our day. When we behold the unchanging love, his sovereign grace, God reigns. The only reason that you and I have cause to be glad this morning, dear friends, is God is sovereign. He is sovereign. His indignation was for my correction, and he is a just and holy God. And I will admire more of his holiness and of his grace. Amen.